began a reading of a book. I read half of it last time. Lord willing, I'll finish the reading of it tonight. It's a book by Gene Edwards entitled A Tale of Three Kings. It is a simple little book. A number of you have asked me if this book is available on CD, and I said, I don't know, but it will be by tonight. So if you'd like to have a copy of it that you can listen to, then you can request that and fill out one of the little request forms in the foyer. And some of you also said, if you order some of these books, I'd like to have one. So I'm not going to take a list tonight, but if you would like one, call the church office and we'll see if we can't order a few. They'll be, I looked it up this afternoon, and they're about 10, I think we can get them delivered for about $10. So if you're interested in one, then we'll see if we can get those. I do recommend the book. It's been quite an influence in my life, and every time I read it, and I've read it numerous times, then I am re-impressed with some things that I think are really important in our lives. So I'm going to take my fireside seat here, and somebody suggested that I bring a pipe, and I said, I don't think that'll work, but anyway. Our last week's reading is entitled A Tale of Three Kings, and it's about three kings and the way that they operate and how it influences others, and it's particularly told from David's standpoint in the first half of the book. There is someone who has authority over him who is out to get him, and how he responds to that. And the last half of the book is someone under his authority who is out to get him and how he responds to that. And so here we go. By the way, this book was written in 1980. I want you to be aware of that, particularly as I read this last half, because there may be any number of things that come to your mind. Look, here comes David. Bright smiles, a few giggles, some light laughter. See, it's David, no less. Again, wide grins, a wave, and quiet amusement. That isn't King David, exclaimed a youth to his guardian as the two walked along the side of the street. Why do they speak that way? That man's not David. True, child. It's not David. It's only Absalom coming up from the gate. Then why do they call him David? The boy asked, looking back over his shoulder at the handsome man in the chariot with 50 men running before him. Because he reminds us all of David when he was young, and because we're all so glad that such a fine young man will take David's place someday. And perhaps, too, because Absalom is even better looking than David. He may be the most handsome man alive. Will Absalom be king soon? How old is King David, anyway? Is he about to die? Of course not, my boy. Let's see. How old is David? Probably about the same age as King Saul when his reign came to an end. How old is Absalom? About the same age as David when Saul was trying so hard to kill him. David is Saul's age. Absalom is the age of David when he first became king, mused the boy. They walked on silently for a while. The boy, obviously deep in thought, spoke again. Saul was very hard on David, was he not? Yes, very. Is King David going to treat Absalom the same way that Saul treated David? Will David be hard on Absalom? The guardian paused to consider the question, but the child went on. If David treats Absalom badly, will Absalom behave with as much grace as David did? Child, the future will surely tell us. My, you ask such questions. If when you're grown you can give answers as well as you now ask questions, you'll surely be known as the wisest man on earth. The two turned in at the palace gate. Chapter 20. It warms your heart to know a man who saw things so clearly. Discerning. Yes, that was the word that best described Absalom. Discerning. He could penetrate to the very heart of any problem. Men felt secure just being with him. They even longed to have time with him. Talking with him, they realized that they themselves were wiser than they realized. Such a revelation made them feel good. As he discussed problem after problem and solution after solution, Men began to long for the day when this one would be their leader. He could right so many wrongs. He gave them such a sense of hope. But this imposing, insightful man would never deliberately hasten the day of his own rule. They were confident of that. He was far too humble, too respectful of his father. And those around him began to feel a little frustrated when they would have to keep waiting for the better days of this man's rule. The more they sat in his living room and talked, the more they realized that things were amiss in the kingdom. Yes, things amiss that they had never thought of before. And problems. Problems were coming to light of which they had never dreamed. Yes, they were really growing in wisdom and insight. As the days passed, more and more of them came to listen. Word spread quietly. Here is one who understands and has the answers. The frustrated came. They listened. They asked questions. They received excellent answers and began to hope. Heads nodded. Dreams were born. As time passed, there were more such gatherings. Ideas turned into stories. Stories of injustice that others might have deemed trivial. But not this listener. He was compassionate. And as those around him talked, the discovered injustices seemed to grow in number and severity. With each new story, men were more shocked at unfairness that was now, it seemed, rampant. But the wise young man sat quietly and added not a word to these murmurings. He was too noble, you see. He always closed the evening conversations with an humble word of deference toward those in positions of responsibility. But it was too much to expect that any man could sit quietly by forever. This endless parade of injustice was bound to stir even the most respectful man. Even the purest in heart would be smitten with anger. And this man was certainly the very purest in heart. Such a compassionate man could not forever turn his face from these sufferings, nor forever remain silent. Such a noble character as this had to speak out someday. Finally, his followers, which he vowed he did not have, were almost livid. Their insights into the wrongdoings of the kingdom not only grew, but abounded. They all wanted to do something about these endless injustices. At last, it seemed, the magnificent young man might concede. At the outset, it was only a word. Later, a sentence. Men's hearts leaped. Joy, if not glee, reigned. Nobility was at last being aroused to action. But no, he cautioned them not to misunderstand. He was grieved, yes, but he would not speak against those in seats of responsibility. No, absolutely not. No matter how great the grievances, no matter how justified the frustrations, he would not. Yet he grieved more and more. It was obvious that some reports drove him to agony. Finally, his righteous anger broke out in a cool, controlled words of strength. These things ought not to be. He stood, eyes blazing. If I were in responsibility, this is what I would do. And with these words, the rebellion was ignited. Ignited in all but one, that is, in the man who seemed noblest and purest. This was not the case. Rebellion had been in his heart for years. Chapter 21. Sage. Yes? Sage, may I have a moment of your time? Why, of course, I have a great deal of time. You've just come from a gathering of friends at Absalom's home? Yes, that's correct. Would you mind sharing some of the impressions you had while there? You mean the general impressions of Absalom and his friends? Yes, that would be good enough. Well, I have met many men like Absalom. Many. Then what is he like? He is both sincere and ambitious. A contradiction, perhaps, but true nonetheless. He probably means some of what he says, but his ambition will continue long after he discovers his inability to do the things he promises. Righting the wrongs always becomes secondary to ascent to power. I'm sorry, Sage, I don't understand. Two things stand out in my mind. At one gathering, when Absalom was answering questions, he was very emphatic that there should be more freedom in the kingdom. Everyone liked that. A people should be led only by God and not by men, he said. Men should do only what they feel led of God to do. We should follow God, not a man. I believe those were his words. In another meeting, he spoke of the great visions he had for God's kingdom, of the great achievements the people were capable of. On the other hand, he spoke of many changes he would make in the way the kingdom is run. Although he did not seem to notice it, he stated two irreconcilable propositions. Many changes, more freedom. Yes, indeed, he does remind me of many other men I have encountered over the passing years. Sage, I think I understand what you said, but I'm not sure what your point is. Absalom dreams. Dreams of what should be, of what will be. This is what I will do, he says. But to fulfill those dreams, he must have the people's cooperation. This is the point often overlooked. Such dreams rest totally on the premise that the people of God will follow the new leader, that all will see as he sees. Such men as Absalom can envision no problems in their future kingdom. Possibly the people will follow, but possibly they will not. At most, the Lord's people will follow a leader for a few years. They never support anyone very long. Generally, people do what they please. They can be stopped to do someone else's pleasure for a time, but not for long. People will not work too hard, even if they are following God. What will Absalom do when people stop following him unwillingly? Let me read that again. What will Absalom do when people stop following him willingly? Now there's a question. You see, there is no kingdom without discord. Even God had his critics in heaven, you know. All kingdoms follow a bumpy course. And people, especially God's people, never follow any dream in unison. No, to accomplish all he spoke of tonight will take time. Not all will be willing to go along. Will he still be determined to put all his dreams into being? If so, then Absalom has but one recourse, dictatorship. Either that, or he will see few, if any, of his grand dreams accomplished. And if he does become a dictator, I can assure you that soon there will be discontent with him, just as there is now with your present king. Yes, if Absalom becomes king, soon thereafter you will see new meetings like the ones we've just come from tonight, only with new faces, new dreams, and plans for a new rebellion. And that gathering will be against Absalom. Then, when Absalom hears of such a meeting and of discussions about a rebellion, he will have but one recourse. What do you feel he will do, Sage? Rebels who ascend to the throne by rebellion have no patience with other rebels in their rebellions. When Absalom is faced with rebellion, he will become a tyrant. He will bring 10 times the evil he sees in your present king. He will squelch rebellion and rule with an iron hand and by fear. He will eliminate all opposition. This is always the final stage of high-sounding rebellion. Such will be Absalom's way if he takes the throne from David. But Sage, have not some rebellions been a benefit, throwing out brutes and despots? Oh, yes, a few. But I remind you, this particular kingdom is different from all others. This kingdom is composed of God's people. It's a spiritual kingdom. I tell you emphatically, no rebellion in the kingdom of God is proper. Nor can it ever be fully blessed. Why do you say this, Sage? For many reasons. One is obvious. In the spiritual realm, those who lead rebellions have already proven, no matter how grandiose their words or angelic their ways, that they have a critical nature, an unprincipled character, and hidden motives in their hearts. Frankly, they are thieves. They create dissatisfaction and tension within the realm and then either seize power or siphon off followers. They use their followers to found their own dominion. Such a sorry beginning built on the foundations of insurrection. No, God never honors divisions in His realm. I find it curious that those who feel qualified to split God's kingdom do not feel capable of going somewhere else, to another land, to raise up a completely new kingdom. No, they must steal from another leader. I've never seen the exception. They always seem to need at least a few prepackaged followers. Beginning empty-handed and alone frightens the best of men. It also speaks volumes of just how sure they are that God is with them. Their every word, if truly understood, tells of their insecurity. There are many lands unspoiled and unpossessed. There are many people in other places waiting to follow a true king, a true man of God. Why don't would-be kings and prophets simply walk quietly away, alone, and then find another people in another place and there raise up the kingdom they envision? Those who lead rebellions in the spiritual world are unworthy. There are no exceptions. And now I must go. I must join the passing parade. Tell me, sage, what is your name? My name? I am history. Chapter 22. David stood on the balcony overlooking the guarded terraces of his palace. The lights from the houses in the holy city twinkled below him. From behind, a man approached. David sighed and, without turning, spoke, "Yes, Joab, what is it? Have you heard?" "Yes, I've heard," he replied quietly. "How long have you known?" asked Joab with anxious surprise. "For months, years, perhaps a decade. Perhaps I have known for 30 years. Joab was not sure after this answer if they were speaking of the same subject. Absalom, after all, was not much past 30. "Sir, I speak of Absalom," he said a little hesitantly. "As do I," said the king. "If you have known so long, why did you not stop him?" "I was just asking myself that same question. Shall I stop him for you?" David whirled around. In one instant, Joab's query had resolved his dilemma. "No, nor shall you speak one word to him, nor shall you criticize him, nor shall you allow anyone else to speak critically of him or what he's doing. You shall certainly not stop him." "But will he not then take the kingdom?" David sighed again, softly, slowly. For a moment he balanced between tears and a smile. Then he smiled lightly and said, "Yes, perhaps he will. What will you do? Do you have plans?" "No, none. Quite frankly, I have no idea what to do. I fought many battles and faced many sieges. I've usually known what to do, but for this occasion, I have only the experience of my youth to draw on. The course I followed at that time seems to be the best course I can follow now." "And what course was that?" "To do absolutely nothing." Chapter 23. David was alone again. Slowly, quietly, he walked the length of his rooftop garden. Finally, he paused and spoke aloud to himself. "I have waited, Absalom. I have waited and watched for years. I have asked again and again, what is in the heart of this young man? And now I know. You will do the unthinkable. You will divide the very kingdom of God. All else was talk." David was quiet for a moment. Then almost in awe, he spoke, his voice hushed. "Absalom does not hesitate to divide the kingdom of God. Now I know he seeks followers, or at least he does not turn them away. Though he seems magnificently pure and noble, still he divides. his followers grow, even though he states convincingly that he has none. For a long time, David said nothing. Finally, with a trace of humor in his words, he began to address himself. All right, good King David, you have one issue resolved. You're in the middle of a division, and you very well may be dethroned. Now to the second issue. He paused, lifted his hand, and almost fatally asked, What will you do? The kingdom hangs in the balance. It seems I have two choices, to lose everything or to be a Saul. I can stop Absalom. I need only be a Saul. In my old age, shall I now become a Saul? I feel the Lord himself awaits my decision. Shall I now be a Saul? He asked himself again, this time loudly. A voice from behind him answered, Good King, he has been no David to you. David turned. It was Abishai, who had approached unannounced. A crowded place, this terrace, quipped David. Sir, said Abishai, nothing. Suffice it to say, I have not been without visitors today, a day when I would have chosen solitude. What did you say to me? In fact, what did I say? You said, Shall I be a Saul to Absalom? And I replied, He has been no young David to you. I never challenged Saul. I never attempted to divide the kingdom during his reign. Is that what you're saying? More, replied Abishai strongly. Saul was evil toward you and made your life torture. You responded only with respect and private agony. The bad things that happened in those days came only from one side. All fell on you. You could have divided the kingdom and probably could have overthrown Saul. But rather than do that, you left the kingdom. You fled rather than cause division. You risked your life for unity and sealed your lips and eyes to all injustices. You had more cause to rebel than any man in the history of this or any other kingdom that has ever been. Absalom has to twist hard to conjure up his list of injustices. Few of them significant, I might add. Has Absalom behaved as you did? Has Absalom respected you? Does Absalom seek to preserve the kingdom? Does he refuse to speak against you? Does Absalom turn aside followers? Has Absalom left the land to prevent its being sundered? Is Absalom respectable? Does he bear suffering in silent agony? Have bad things fallen on Absalom? No, he is only pure and noble. Abishai's last words came out almost in bites. Then he continued more gravely this time. His grievances are minor compared to your rightful grievances toward Saul. You never mistreated Saul. And you have never in any way been unfair to Absalom. David interrupted with a grin. I seem to have a gift for making old men and young men hate me without a cause. In my youth, the old attacked me. And now when I'm old, the young attack me. What a marvelous achievement. My point, continued Abishai, is that Absalom is no David. Therefore, I ask you, why don't you stop his rebellion? Stop him, the miserable, careful Abishai. Remember, he's also the son of the king. We should never speak ill of the son of the king. Good king, I remind you that you refused to raise your sword or your spear even once against Saul. But Absalom speaks against you night and day. He will one day, soon, raise an army against you. Nay, a nation. This nation. Young Absalom is no young David. I counsel you to stop him. You're asking me, Abishai, to become a Saul, David replied heavily. No, I'm simply saying he is no David. Stop him. And if I stop him, will I still be a David? If I stop him, will I not be a Saul? Asked the king, his eyes piercing Abishai. To stop him, I must become either a Saul or an Absalom. My king and my friend, I spoke to you fondly. I sometimes think you're a bit insane. Yes, I can see why, chuckled David. Dear king, Saul was a bad king. Absalom is, in some ways, a youthful incarnation of Saul. You alone are constant. You're forever the broken-hearted shepherd boy. Tell me truthfully, what do you plan? Until now, I've not been sure, but of this I am certain. In my youth, I was no Absalom, and in my old age, I shall not be a Saul. In my youth, by your own words, I was David. In my old age, I intend to still be David, even if it cost me a throne, a kingdom, and perhaps my head. Abishai said nothing for a while. Then slowly he spoke, making sure he grasped the significance of David's decision. You were not an Absalom, and you refused to be a Saul. Sir, if you're not willing to put Absalom down, then I suggest we prepare to evacuate the kingdom, for Absalom will surely take the throne. Only as surely as King Saul killed the shepherd boy, replied the wise old king. What? Asked Abishai, startled. Think on it, Abishai. God once delivered a defenseless shepherd boy from a powerful mad king. He can yet deliver an old ruler from an ambitious young rebel. You underestimate your adversary, retorted Abishai. You underestimate my God, replied David serenely. But why, David? Why not fight? I will give you the answer, and you will recall, for you were there, that I once gave this same answer to Joab in a cave long ago. It is better that I be defeated, even killed, than to learn the ways of a Saul or the ways of an Absalom. The kingdom is not that valuable. Let him have it, if that be the Lord's will. I repeat, I shall not learn the ways of either Saul or Absalom. And now, being an old man, I will add a word I might not have known then. Abishai, no man knows his own heart. I certainly do not know mine. Only God does. Shall I defend my little realm in the name of God? Shall I throw spears and plot and divide and kill men's spirits, if not their bodies, to protect my empire? I did not lift a finger to be made king, nor shall I do so to preserve a kingdom. Even the kingdom of God. God put me here. It's not my responsibility to take or keep authority. Do you not realize it may be His will for those things to take place? If He chooses, God can protect and keep the kingdom even now. After all, it is His kingdom. As I said, no man knows his own heart. I do not know mine. Who really knows what is really in my heart? Perhaps in God's eyes I'm no longer worthy to rule. Perhaps He is through with me. Perhaps it's His will for Absalom to rule. I honestly don't know. And if that's His will, I want it. God may be finished with me. Any young rebel who raises his hand against a Saul or any old king who raises his hand against an Absalom may, in truth, be raising his hand against the will of God. In either case, I shall raise no hand. Wouldn't I look a little strange trying to stay in control if God desires that I fall? But you know that Absalom should not be king, replied Abishai in frustration. Do I? No man knows. Only God knows, and He has not spoken. I did not fight to be king, and I will not fight to remain king. May God come tonight and take the throne, the kingship, and, David's voice faltered, and His anointing from me. I seek His will, not His power. I repeat, His will more than I desire a position of leadership I desire. He may be through with me. King David? A voice came from behind the two men. Yes? Oh, a messenger. What is it? Absalom. He wishes to see you a moment. He wants to ask permission to go to Hebron to make a sacrifice. David? Said Abishai hoarsely. Do you do know what that really means, don't you? Yes, I do. David turned to the messenger. Tell Absalom I'll be there in a moment. David looked one last time at the quiet city below and turned and walked toward the door. Will you let him go to Hebron? Abishai demanded. I will, said the great king. Yes, I will. Then he turned to the messenger. This is a dark hour for me. When I finish speaking to Absalom, I shall retire. Tomorrow have one of the prophets come to me for consultation, or a scribe. On second thought, send me Zadok, the high priest. Ask him to join me here after the evening sacrifice. Abishai called out once more, softly this time. Admiration flashed across his face. Good king, thank you. For what? The puzzled king asked as he turned back in the doorway. Not for what you have done, but for what you have not done. Thank you for not throwing spears, for not rebelling against kings, for not exposing a man in authority when he was so very vulnerable, for not dividing a kingdom, for not attacking young Absaloms who look like young Davids but are not. He paused. And thank you for suffering, for being willing to lose everything. Thank you for giving God a free hand to end and even destroy your kingdom, if it pleases him. Thank you for being an example to us all. And most of all, he chuckled, thank you for not consulting witches. Chapter 24. Nathan. Yes? Oh, it's you, Zadok. Will you pardon my intrusion, Nathan, but I have been observing you for several moments now. You were about to enter the throne room, I believe, to see King David. Yes, Zadok, that was my intent, but I thought better of it. The king has no need of me. I'm disappointed, Nathan. In my judgment, the king has great need of you. He's facing the gravest test of his life, and I'm not sure he can pass a test as demanding as this one. He has already passed the test, Zadok. Countered Nathan with a sureness in his voice that showed him to be a prophet of God. David has already passed the test? Forgive me, Nathan, but I have no idea what you mean. This crisis, as you well know, has just begun. Zadok, your king passed this test a long time ago when he was a young man. You speak of Saul? But that, my friend, was a wholly different matter. Not at all. It is exactly the same. There's really no difference at all. As David related to his God and to the man over him at that time long ago, so now David will also relate to his God and the man under him. There can be no difference. Not ever. True circumstances may be altered slightly. Ever so slightly, I might add. But the heart. The heart. It's always the same. Zadok, I've always been grateful Saul was our first king. I shudder to think of the trouble he might have caused if, as a young man, he had found himself under some other king. There's no real difference between the man who discovers a Saul in his life and the man who finds an Absalom in his life. In either situation, the corrupt heart will find its justification. The Sauls of this world can never see a David. They can only see Absalom. And the Absaloms of this world can never see a David, only a Saul. And the pure heart? Asked Zadok. Ah, now there's a rare thing indeed. How does a man with a broken heart handle an Absalom? The way he handled a Saul? We'll soon know, Zadok. You and I were not privileged to be there when David came to his hour with Saul, but we are privileged to be present in his hour with Absalom. I, for one, intend to watch this unfolding drama very closely, and in so doing, I have good expectation of learning a lesson or two. Mark my words. David will work his way through this thing, and he'll pass the test with the same grace he displayed in his youth. And Absalom? What of Absalom? In a few hours, he may be our king. Is that not your point? There is that possibility, replied Zadok, almost with humor. Nathan laughed. If Absalom gains the throne, may heaven have mercy on all our souls, on all the Sauls, the Davids, and the Absaloms of the realm. In my judgment, our young Absalom will make a splendid Saul, continued Nathan as he turned and strolled down the long corridor. Yes, a splendid Saul, for in every way but age and position, Absalom is already a Saul. Chapter 25. I thank you for coming, Zadok, my king. You're a priest of God. Could you tell me a story of long ago? What story, my king? Do you know the story of Moses? I do. Tell it to me. It's long. Shall I tell it all? No, not all. Then what part? Tell me about Korah's rebellion. The high priest stared at David with eyes burning. David stared back, his also ablaze. The two men understood. I shall tell you the story of Korah's rebellion and of Moses' behavior in the midst of that rebellion. Many have heard the story of Moses. He's the supreme example of the Lord's anointed. God's true government rests upon a man. No, upon the contrite hearts of a man. There is no form or order to God's government. There is only a man or a woman with contrite heart. Moses was such a man. Korah was not such a man, although he was the first cousin of Moses. Korah wanted the authority Moses had. One peaceful morning, Korah awoke. There was no discord among God's people that morning, but before the day was over, he had found 252 men to agree with his charges against Moses. Then there were problems in the nation when Moses ruled? Asked David. There are always problems in any kingdom, replied Zadok. Always. Furthermore, the ability to be able to see those problems is a cheap gift indeed. David smiled and asked, but Zadok, you know there have been unjust kingdoms and unjust rulers and pretenders and liars who've ruled and governed. How can simple people know which is a kingdom with faults but led by men of God and which is a kingdom unworthy of men's submission? How can a people know? David stopped. He realized that he had hit upon what he wished to know most of all. Heavily he spoke again. And the king, how can he know? Can he know if he's just? Can he know if the charges are of great worth? Are there signs? David's final words were anxious. Are you looking for some list let down from heaven, David? Even if there were such a list, even if there were a way to know, wicked men would arrange their kingdoms to fit that list. And if such a list existed and a good man filled it to perfection, there would be rebels claiming he had not fulfilled one qualification. You underestimate the human heart, David. Then how shall the people know? They cannot know. You mean that in the midst of 100 voices making 1,000 claims, the simple people of God have no assurance of who is truly anointed to bear God's authority and who is not? They can never be certain. Who then can know? God always knows, but he does not tell. Is there no hope then for those who must follow unworthy men? Their grandchildren will be able to see the matter clearly. They will know. But those caught up in the drama, they can never be certain. Nonetheless, a good thing will come from it all. What's that? As surely as the sun rises, people's hearts will be tested. Despite the many claims, the counterclaims, the hidden motives within the hearts of all who are involved, they will be revealed. This might not seem important in the eyes of men, but in the eyes of God, such things are central. The motives of the heart will eventually be revealed. God will see to it. I despise such tests, replied David wearily. I hate such nights as this one. Yet God seems to send many, many things into my life to test this heart of mine. Once more, this night, I find my heart on trial. Zadok, there is something that bothers me above all else. Perhaps God is finished with me. Is there not some way for me to know? I know of no other ruler in all history who would even ask such a question, good king. Most other men would have ripped their opponents, or even their imagined opponent, to shreds by now. But to answer your question, I know of no way for you to be certain that God is or is not finished with you. David sighed and choked back a sob, then continued with the story. Korah had 252 followers, did he? What happened next? Korah approaches Moses and Aaron with his followers. He informs Moses that he had no right to all the authority he exercised. Well, we Hebrews are consistent, aren't we? Laughed David. No, the heart of man is consistent, David, replied Zadok. Tell me, what was Moses' response to Korah? At the age of 40, Moses had been an arrogant, self-willed man, not unlike Korah. What he might have done at 40, I cannot say. At 80, he was a broken man. He was, David interrupted, the meekest man who ever lived. The man who carried the rod of God's authority should be. Otherwise, God's people will live in terror. Yes, a broken man faced Korah, and I believe you already know what Moses did. David, he did nothing. Nothing. Ah, what a man. He fell on his face before God. That's all he did. Why did he do that, Zadok? David, you of all men must know. Moses knew that God alone had put him in charge of Israel. There was nothing that needed to be done. Korah and his 252 followers would seize the kingdom, or God would vindicate Moses. Moses knew that. Men would find it hard to imitate such a life, would they not? An impostor surely would not fake such surrender, could he? But tell me, how did God vindicate Moses? Moses told the men to return the next day with censers and incense, and God would decide the issue. So, cried David, so, he exclaimed again, even louder, sometimes God does tell, he said excitedly. Please continue. Korah and two of his friends were swallowed by the earth. The other 250 died by... Never mind, said David. Suffice it to say that Moses was proven to be in authority by God. God did tell. The people knew who really was, who really had authority from God. And at last, Moses had rest. No, David, he did not find rest. And the people were not satisfied with God's answer. The very next day, the whole congregation murmured against Moses, and they would have all died except for the prayers of Moses. And men fight to become kings. David shook his head in perplexity. Zadok paused, then continued, David, I perceive that you're torn by the question of what's true authority and what's not. You want to know what to do in a rebellion, if indeed it is a rebellion and not the hand of God. I trust you will find the only pure thing to do and do it, and thereby you will teach us all. The door opened. Abishai rushed in. Good king, your son, your own flesh and blood, has proclaimed himself king in Hebron. At first impression, it seems all Israel has gone over to him. He plans to take the throne. He marches toward Jerusalem. Some of the men closest to you have gone over to him. David walked away. He spoke quietly to himself. Israel's third king? Do true leaders of the kingdom of God gain authority in this way? Zadok, not certain if he should be hearing David's words or not, spoke out, My king? David turned, his eyes moist. At last, David said quietly, at last this matter will be resolved. Perhaps tomorrow someone besides God will know. Perhaps, said Zadok, but perhaps not. Such questions may be debated even after we're all long dead. That might also be tomorrow, laughed David. Go, Abishai. Tell Joab. You'll find him in the turret of the east wall. Abishai departed as he had entered, in haste and in fury. I wonder, Zadok, mused David, if a man can force God into a position where he must tell. Chapter 26. Abishai rushed across the courtyard into the eastern rampart where he charged up the spiral staircase. At the top of the stairs, Joab stared down at Abishai. In the flickering light of torches, each man studied the face of the other. Abishai spoke. Have you heard, Joab? Have I heard? 'Tis midnight, yet half the city is awake with the word. How can it be, Abishai? A son against his own father. When kingdoms are vulnerable, men see queer sights. Responded Abishai with a distant stare. And they'll sacrifice anything to satisfy ambition, added Joab angrily. What think you of these things, Abishai? What think I? Responded Abishai.